possibly a knight or a bishop in some religious game, who fits only within the categories of dogma and of law. Dogma is what you have to believe, whether you believe it or not, and law is what you must do, whether it is good for you or not. What we have to believe or do now, by contrast, is real life, bursting with interesting, frightening, and relevant things and people. Now, in fact, Jesus and his words have never belonged to the categories of dogma or law, and to read them as if they did is simply to miss them. They are essentially subversive of established arrangements and ways of thinking. That is clear from the way they first entered the world, their initial effects, and how they are preserved in the New Testament writings and live on in his people. He himself described his words as spirit and life. John 6, verse 63. They invade our real world with a reality even more real than it is, which explains why human beings then and now have to protect themselves against them. Dogma and law, wrongly perhaps, but understandably, have come to have about them an air of arbitrariness. Because of how our minds have come down to us through history, dogma and law for most people today simply mean what God has willed. This view makes them important and also dangerous, and that is appropriately acknowledged. But it breaks any connection with our sense of how things really are, with truth and reality. And our real life is our truth and reality. It is where things actually happen, not a realm of supposed-to-bes that only threaten to make life harder or possibly unbearable. The life and words that Jesus brought into the world came in the form of information and reality. He and his early associates overwhelmed the ancient world because they brought into it a stream of life at its deepest, along with the best information possible on the most important matters. These were matters with which the human mind had already been seriously struggling for a millennium or more without much success. The early message was, accordingly, not experienced as something its hearers had to believe or do, because otherwise something bad, something with no essential connection with real life, would happen to them. The people initially impacted by that message generally concluded that they would be fools to disregard it. That was the basis of their conversion. Jesus himself was thought of as someone to admire and respect, someone you thought highly of, and considered to be a person of great ability. Worship of him included this, not as today, ruled it out. This attitude was naturally conveyed in such New Testament names and phrases as the Prince of Life, the Lord of Glory, Abundant Life, the Inexhaustible Riches of Christ, and so on. Today, these phrases are emptied of most intellectual and practical content. It is the failure to understand Jesus and his words as reality and vital information about life that explains why, today, we do not routinely teach those who profess allegiance to him how to do what he said was best. We lead them to profess allegiance to him, or we expect them to, and leave them there, devoting our remaining efforts to attracting them to this or that. True, you will find few scholars or leaders in Christian circles who deny that we are supposed to make disciples or apprentices to Jesus and teach them to do all things that Jesus said. There are a few here and there, but they are at least not widely influential. Jesus' instructions on this matter are, after all, starkly clear. We just don't do what he said. We don't seriously attempt it. And apparently, we don't know how to do it. You have only to look honestly at our official activities to see this. It saddens me to say such things, and I do not mean to condemn anyone, but it is a matter of extreme importance, and unless it is openly acknowledged, nothing can be done about it. So one is bound to look for an explanation of this state of affairs. How could the obligation be so clear, and at the same time there be no attempt to meet it? The problem, we may be sure, lies very deep within the ideas that automatically govern our thinking about who we are, as Christians and as human beings, and about the relevance of Jesus to our cosmos and our lives. In fact, it lies much deeper than anything we might appropriately feel guilty about, for it is not truly a matter of anything we do or don't do. It is a matter of how we cannot but think and act, given the context of our mental and spiritual formation. So any significant change can come only by breaking the stranglehold of the ideas and